host Kyle. He's co-founder of Cedar, and I had the opportunity to work with him briefly in the Chicago AC Tech event, where we were like brainstorming speakers and bring, and he had such a great passion for AC Tech. And when I started seeing him building Cedar, the journey has been, I thought like I should definitely get him on the show. So first of all, Kyle, congrats on the recent fundraise. I know how challenging it is. So.
Yeah, no, thanks, Mayor. Thanks for having me. I've been following, obviously we've been friends for a long time, and I remember your AEC podcast from a few years ago now. I remember you got some really exciting, really cool people I looked up to in the industry on there, and had some really kind of informal and frank and honest conversations. So I'm glad we're finally doing this.
And you made it. You are the new cool guest on the show. People are looking forward to your work. So it's like I've seen some like glimpses of like the problem you're solving, and it's speaks to its core. Can you, like, before we dive deeper into Cedar, tell us like your college journey, your professional life, what are some highlights?
Yeah, definitely. I come from an architecture background. I did my undergrad in construction engineering and then did a master's degree in structural engineering, but eventually came around to architecture. It was kind of always my deepest passion, but I have kind of an analytical mind as well. And I sort of formed this approach to design through, again, engineering meeting architecture, as really thinking about kind of objects and buildings as holistic, holistic approaches to understanding sort of how a lot of things integrate into one. And so in architecture school, I had spent some time at Thornton Tomasetti, and had worked as a structural engineer, I realized that there was something really exciting about integrating structural systems and structural optimization and the kind of geometric drivers within kind of structural optimization into architectural design, and really pushing the potential of form and how that integrated with fabrication. That's a lot, but that was really my focus in grad school. And it sort of culminated in this pavilion that me and two other friends who are now my co-founders all kind of designed and built together. From that point on, I became obsessed with the idea of computational design as a link and as a design driver between the design process and the fabrication and construction process. After that, after kind of catching the generative design bug, as they say, I went to Foster and Partners, worked on some pretty exciting projects, and then ended up at SOM, where I really spent most of my career. And spent a lot of time there with Raul Atreya, who's one of my other co-founders, really working on complex projects all over the world, super tall towers, new cities, museums in the Middle East, exciting mixed use commercial projects in the US with big kind of important missions to be landmarks in their cities. Did a lot of really exciting work with Raul at SOM. And my third co-founder, Nate Peters, he, again, went to architecture school. We all went to architecture school together. He ended up being so kind of obsessed with generative design that he went to Harvard, became a structural or a software engineer, and then was a product leader in the generative design group at Autodesk. Believe it or not, we ended up working a lot together through our kind of collaboration between SOM and Autodesk. And we're using a lot of the software that he was building kind of at the cutting edge of generative design as a way to push the potential for, again, kind of integrated optimization between structural engineering and architecture at SOM. So that's a lot. I don't know if you'll need a pause, but you know, it again, really sort of you know, this journey across, you know, kind of multidisciplinary practice and working together with some friends across a lot of different interests within the project of getting, you know, really important buildings built, really taught us that there's incredible potential to, I don't want to say democratize, but broaden the implementation of sophisticated, efficient, high quality design to a much broader space of built environment typologies or typologies within the built environment.
That's so amazing, because I could correlate a lot. Like, you had like a different journey. You started from architecture and then studied structural engineering. I started structural engineering and then studied architecture. But like, I think like one of the least talked topic about the industry, about like architecture engineering in general, is like sometimes there's things you have to unlearn and learn. It's a different profession, like both architecture and structural engineering. So what were some major challenges when you're like navigating and learning these fields, and what has been your like passion when you were like navigating your journey of architectural engineering?
Yeah.
What excited?
No, actually, this is a fascinating question. I hadn't ever thought of it this way, but yeah, there's been a lot of unlearning, mainly because, you know, architecture and structural engineering require you to go so deep on some topics. And it's important because, you know, buildings are very complex things that inherently are very risky to build and operate, and they have to be held to a high standard, right? They have to promote the health, safety, and well-being of its occupants, right? That's not a small bar to meet. So you have to go really deep on some subjects, which makes it actually harder to kind of back out and look at the big picture, especially when you're trying to build, you know, say a new company in a somewhat new space for you, me. But I would say, you know, the first kind of big learning and unlearning was, okay, how can computational design, generative design, whatever you want to call it, for me, it was Grasshopper, right? Grasshopper and yeah, sort of C-based vector math, right? How could sort of understanding the relationship between form and force in the context of computational design actually meet the needs of construction, right? Like, we can do incredible things in our computers. How do you get them out of the computer and into the construction site in a way that are onto the construction site in the form of buildings that are actually easier and cheaper to build, right? That's a really complex topic. And so when you go really deep on optimization and sort of pushing the boundaries of expression in the buildings that you're designing, it often makes it harder to simply build them. Right. We all have our favorite examples of this. Right. I won't say kind of Starkitect names on this, but, you know, we spent a lot of time at SOM and worked with some incredible engineers and architects at SOM that really helped us. You know, we sort of figured it out together, you know, ways to introduce, whether it be robotically formed formwork or using robotics in ways that made it cheaper and faster to mill structural timber. There are all kinds of exciting ways that you can actually leverage digital fabrication to make it easier for people in the field to get projects built that were actually, you know, significantly less, had significantly less embodied carbon, were actually faster and more standardized to build. So I mean, kind of go on and on and on, but yeah, unlearning some of the complexity around design or how to make design more complex was one of the first big unlearnings. The second big one has just been, you know, what we're building at Cedar, which is, you know, essentially taking a lot of that, you know, that kind of computational approach to productizing design for a certain building type. And in the case of my career, it was, you know, landmark buildings. Now it's infill housing and mixed use multifamily projects in urban centers, right? So it's it's something that not as many architects are focused on, and the design community is not as focused on. And so adapting a sort of early stage design solution to a market that's not used to, you know, a significant focus on design and early stage feasibility has been another big unlearning. I'll stop there, but I really like the question, and hopefully that answers it.
No, you gave a great perspective. And like, it made me like think, like during my architecture engineering journey, like I had phases of like typology excitement. Like at one point earlier in my career, I was very obsessed with tall buildings design. And then I was very much passionate about spatial stadium like structures and like tensile membranes and stuff like that. Did you had like similar journey for yours where there were like, what were different phases in your architecture journey and different excitements, or it was like, okay, I knew the path?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's this natural desire when you first start your career to push the ambition of your work, right? So, you know, probably not unlike you, the first thing that I focused on in my career was super talls, right? And spent a lot of time designing, you know, towers that are 500 meters tall, you know, plus in China and the Middle East. One's actually under construction now, and I'm, you know, super excited to at some point see it complete. It's in Xi'an, China. And yeah, really allowed to kind of flex some sort of design and rationalization muscles, right? But that was, yeah, definitely one stage of my career. Second half of my time at SOM was really focused on office buildings and sort of, I wouldn't say commoditized projects. I mean, there are still, you know, very exciting projects, you know, working in Chicago, New York, but, you know, they had a different pressure, right? They had much more of a kind of pro forma based pressure. And so if we wanted to introduce innovation, we had to do it in an economical way. And so, yeah, I mean, definitely. And you know, spent time designing museums and a lot of other exciting projects too, but I totally echo that sentiment that, yeah, our careers tend to, you know, allow us to, you know, or there's just a natural inclination to look at different typologies and understand how to innovate on them and push their boundaries within, you know, especially their urban contexts.
Yeah. Because like those are the typology where you could leverage best of both worlds knowledge, like architectural and structural engineering. Is there's room for form innovation, but also there's room for structural optimization. And like one of the reasons, like when I went to like UIUC, like I used to be like a big like role model of mine was Fazlur Khan, his tall building. And so I'm actually curious, who do you have any role models in architectural engineering and your top three favorite buildings or typologies?
Yeah, I mean, my personal role model that I worked with, you know, for a long time was Bill Baker, who, you know, is obviously probably the most important structural engineer of our time. You know, Bill Baker and Fleet Block are sort of my heroes. Again, you know, it was sort of an ability to, and a desire to really push the boundaries of what's possible along a very clear ethical line, which was, you know, more efficient structures that were more authentically expressed in their form. So we did a lot of, you know, really exciting projects together, and I was very, very lucky and fortunate to work with him and during my time at SOM. And, you know, he has always been and continues to do really exciting work. So, and then the other one was the three favorite buildings. Oh man. Yeah. This is like the hardest, like architects are the worst answering this question because they have so many thoughts. I mean, I'll say like my favorite architecture right now is actually in Mexico. My wife is from Mexico, so I spend a lot of time there. And Alberto Kalich, I don't know if you know him, but he's got a library in Mexico City called Biblioteca Vasconcelos. And yeah, I don't know. It's a really incredible project. And then, you know, there's a number of other projects that he has in Mexico City. And you know, Merida and Yucatan. And yeah, I don't know. That's my favorite architect of the moment, I will say.
You answered one building.
The one building. Yeah, well, let's see. It's always of the moment. I mean, my heroes are Norman Foster, you know, Bill Baker, and probably Zaha to a certain extent, right? There are some projects I love, and there are some projects that I'm not sure about. But you know, her as a you know, as a force in architecture, yeah, you know, she's incredible. She's a hero. Can we, yeah, let's just leave it at that. I mean, every Norman Foster,
okay, yeah, no problem,
built,
no problem.
You know, you can. and there's a, yeah, a few other really cool. I mean, Roth, I don't know if anyone, on this this LinkedIn studio, whatever that we're calling this, knows Roth, but it's a little studio in Tulum that does really expressive organic architecture. It's really cool.
That's nice. I'll check it out. Okay, now you were working in a corporate job, and then what was the point you started tinkering about startup? How were those early days, the seed idea, and how it evolved? Can you walk us through those moments?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I wouldn't call working at SOM corporate, although some people do. It was very, very experimental and actually very innovative. It was a really amazing place to work. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we had an insight, you know, Raul and I working together, again, doing really exciting projects, pushing the boundaries of, you know, digital design fabrication in practice. And then obviously always, you know, spending the weekends talking to Nate, spending the weekdays, but, you know, especially spending the weekends talking to Nate about ideas. I think there was this belief that generative design, as, you know, as we called it then, I think that phrase has evolved a bit, but, you know, this ability to kind of generate a design space of possibilities based on a, you know, pretty robust parametric model, you know, that had bigger potential than maybe what we were leveraging it for in practice. And we really saw it as a kind of UI for architecture. Which means it, again, I think I said this earlier, like it sort of allows you to broaden the base, or I just don't want to say the word democratize, but broaden the scope of what you could apply sort of constraint-based parametric modeling or generative design, expand the potential of where you could apply that to if you thought about it as a scalable UI and not just sort of a mess of kind of grasshopper scripts and, you know, hack together, you know, workflows, right? Like really think about generative design as a software platform to enable broader scopes of design. So we were never quite sure, like, where would you do this? Like, how would you actually build software like this? You know, we knew we didn't want to continue to build non-scalable software in practice. So there was, you know, we really spent a lot of time thinking, like, what is the biggest problem that we could go apply this technology to? And it became very clear to us. I don't know exactly which year it became clear, but, you know, housing is a massive problem for our generation. We've got, you know, dramatic undersupply issues in most urban centers in the United States. There's this, you know, huge transition in the United States from single family zoning to, you know, denser mixed use zoning. And we wanted to be a part of that. You know, we want to support that and make it easier for the design and development community to help our cities make that transition. And, you know, it became clear to us over a period of time that productizing infill housing and mixed use development was a really exciting idea to go, you know, test this technology against or to test it as a solution for. And so in late 2022, we sort of just made the decision to all quit at the same time. And, Raul was already living here in Austin, Texas. And I moved here, you know, not too long after, but, Austin's kind of the epicenter of the housing crisis, right? In some ways, it's a city in transition and, it's got a very complicated land development code. It's got a lot of reasons why it's really difficult to figure out simply what I can build and where, right? From an infill housing and mixed use perspective. So it wasn't totally scientific, our selection of Austin, Texas, but it's turned out to be a great choice as our first city for Cedar. And yeah, it's a great place to build a company.
Amazing. And how much time did it took from the idea for the MVP?
Which MVP and which idea? you know, it's funny, when we first started, we built a product that was pretty ambitious, right? It basically said, we're going to allow you to design your own home in the browser on the fly. And then we'll take that all the way through to kind of, you know, supply chain and material procurement alignment with the design, with the generative design process, and into fabrication and, you know, delivery to your new front door. And, you know, we're architects who are really good at kind of designing this incredible vision, and we mocked it up, you know, beautiful UI and wireframes. We started to build the product, and we, you know, took it to market, you know, essentially started asking developers and planners and homeowners, anyone that would talk to us in Austin, what they thought of it. And everyone sort of said the same thing. This is incredible. I'm not sure how we're going to use this. This is way too much technology. But in those conversations, it was clear that we were building way too ambitious of a product. You know, when you go from architecture into startup world, or to, you know, building a business world around software, your expectations around what you can deliver have to change dramatically, right? With software, you have to build a really clear, scalable product that has a wedge into a bigger market. And with architecture, it's, you know, we sort of dream and imagine the impossible, and then we render it, and then we, you know, battle for years to get it built. So, you know, we, in taking this very ambitious product to market, everyone said, great, it's too much for me, not going to use it, but could you help us figure out how to interpret the land development code and the zoning regulations here? Because it's actually really complicated, and we don't know what we can build. Or it's really hard to figure out what you can build on a given property within the city. Every parcel's different, you know, zoning rules and regulations change by neighborhood, sometimes by like the side of street or the specific parcel you're on. There's trees, topography, easements. There's just an incredible amount of complexity that makes it really hard to get off the ground with feasibility and early stage design, you know, really understanding what you can build and how to underwrite to it for infill projects. So when we heard that over and over and over again, we shifted our focus towards building a product to support that. And so the first product we built, you know, sort of MVP 2 or 3, was basically a fully digitized land development code, land use density, all of those requirements in one place, a sort of digital mapping of what you can build, development yield across the city. And we're not the first ones that have built that. But I think what we learned and what we've done that's different is that we've taken, you know, all of the complexity around, we've gone really deep, right? So we've taken all of the complexity around, you know, every little ordinance that gets passed on a monthly basis at city council. We've taken sort of all of that, you know, and we've converted into geospatialized overlays that simply, you know, map the constraints, you sort of physical mapping of the constraints of what you can build across the city. And that actually makes it really easy to understand what development yield looks like on a parcel by parcel basis. And so we've tested that out across a number of different typologies, but that's fundamentally the product we're building.
I see. And from once you realized that that was the problem you wanted to focus on, what was your like strategy to get early adopters? Because like, it's one of the challenges of building startup is, our industry is known for not so friendly to test out or try out new tech products. So.
Yeah, I mean, if you have any suggestions, let me know. you know, it's a, yeah, and, you know, I hear a lot, right, about tech adoption in our industry. You know, I often hear that we have too much tech and not enough adoption, right? You hear the common, you know, the industry, the AEC industry underinvests in research and development and underinvests in technology. I know that on paper that's correct. But yeah, I mean, I do think we have an adoption issue, but I'm not sure that that's always our customer's problem. Like, I think they're taking incredible amounts of risk. And so they have to rely on legacy processes that, you know, essentially de-risk their projects and provide consistent outcomes in a really unpredictable field, right? And so I think there's a lot of empathy that goes into it, just like understanding that just because somebody isn't adopting your technology doesn't mean that on our end it's not valuable, and on their end they're not, you know, open to progress and open to efficiency and innovation. It just means that there's this gap, right, between what your product does and what our customers potentially need it to do in terms of risk. And so we really focus on that. We really focus on what is the gap between where our customers are at now and where they want to be. We're trying to understand those outcomes, not in the context of technology, but in the context of the deliverables that they have to deal with, the outcomes that they have to deal with. So I don't know if I'm answering your question. This is sort of like a meditation on how do we understand, you know, why our customers do and don't buy things. But I do think our industry requires a lot of incubation in the sort of like buying process. Like, we really have to help our customers along to understand, like, we have to meet them where they're at, right? So oftentimes we find ourselves building parts of our tech stack that look very similar to Excel, look very similar to what they're already using. And it's a really nice kind of on-ramp into more complex things, right? Because we'll do sort of full kind of generative design feasibility analysis. We'll run hundreds of scenarios on a given site. We'll show you all of the different, you know, yield and design options across like a risk adjusted basis, right? Tell you, you know, from kind of NIMBY to YIMBY what you can build on a given property. But they may not be there yet, right? They may just be trying to understand what are the opportunities that are in front of them. What are the high level risks that are going to affect a property's potential? And, you know, once we get there, right? But really building an on-ramp for our customers into this kind of technology is really important.
That's a great insight. I was like looking, what is one tip or trick you could share to get in touch with contractor? Like, was like the cold reach out worked, or did like meeting contractor in an event, like any strategic thinking you could share?
Yeah, no, again, like any insights from you would be great. I mean, for us, you know, I think you said contractors. For us, most of our customers are not contractors, they're actually developers. And believe it or not, developers, they have far less tech adoption within their field than contractors, and they take more risk oftentimes. I mean, credibility is important, right? Like, oftentimes you don't see that kind of early growth like you see in other startups. Like, I often wish that we could get into that, and maybe I'm saying too much now, but get into that process, you know, the sort of like efficient or lean startup process where you have one customer and then you have two and you just slowly build and everything compounds on itself over time. And I just don't think that that's the way you can build. I mean, maybe some startups are building that way in our industry, but I think it probably takes a longer period of time to really establish credibility in our industry. And you really have to establish a level of confidence in the outcomes of your product over time. And I think once you do that, and we've started to see some of this, once you establish credibility, you become a bit of a source of truth for outcomes, people really trust you and trust your product, then I think it's much easier to start to grow faster. Got it. But yeah, just, you know, can't can't stop talking about risk. It's just everything in our industry. And so at least in the field that I, that we're building Seer for. And so it just takes a while to kind of incubate credibility and build a product that's good enough to really service their needs.
Yeah, it's definitely a different patience game. And I echo with like the credibility. Like, if possible, can you share like during this idea maze of developing Seer, what were some difficult choices you have to make? What were some no's to product development or some no's to problem which you could solve, you had to make to focus on that niche?
Yeah, I mean, we're learning every day. Like, we don't have this figured out yet. I would say like the probably the biggest strength and also weakness for architects going to build companies, you know, software companies specifically, is the challenge between services and doing things that don't scale and building things that scale, right? There's the, you know, everyone loves to kind of talk about the doing things that don't scale. I don't know if that's a Paul Grahamism or whoever said that first, but doing things that don't scale, like, man, we love doing that as architects, right? We'll do that all day. And, you know, we love to prove our value and we love to show people what's possible, right? It's just kind of built into our DNA as designers and builders, right? We just, there's just this natural through our optimism, you know, our optimistic personalities to just show what's possible and then figure it out later, right? Or at least maybe that's just me, but it feels like that's kind of a natural inclination of our profession, which is good. Like, why would you design something that's not going to be built for 5 years and the odds of it actually getting built are pretty low? Well, it's because if it does get built, it'll be around for 100 years and will have an incredible impact on where you live and or where the people that you're building it for live and work. But yeah, you have to sometimes, like as architects, you actually have to resist the doing things that don't scale. I find myself having to do this all the time. Like, we have to find a wedge, right? We have to find a scalable product that, you know, has a kind of unit economic that makes sense, right? And that doesn't mean that we can't build really exciting, really ambitious products. It just means that we have to take a longer term understanding or horizon, you know, understanding of the horizon that's going to take to build this and understand the effects of compounding, right? So as architects, we get a project, we sink our heart and soul into it. And a year later, you know, we have maybe, you know, an SD or a DD set and it's done, right? But with a product, it's never done, you know? And so it is an infinite thing, right? But you have to think in sort of clear, finite steps to build that infinite thing. And so, yeah, this, I'm probably rambling, but this sort of tension between like doing things that don't scale to service our industry because our industry runs on projects and, you know, and sort of human-based ingenuity and creativity, that's what our industry is fueled by, you know, tempering that with scalable product-based solutions that compound over time, like, we still haven't figured that out. And I sort of ask myself every day, like, how do we solve our customers' problems without doing things that don't scale, you know? And that's, I don't know, maybe it's a counter VCism, but yeah, I would just love to solve our customers' problems through a product that scales.
Yeah, it's like chicken and egg. Like, you want to solve customer problem and sometimes you have to do things that don't scale, but then you have to find components which a lot of the customers would also benefit and then productivize that.
Yeah, because if you build a product that's built to scale, oftentimes it's too horizontal or too generic for industry. People look at it and they say, this is great, but like, this is not going to get me a permit six weeks faster, you know, and it's not going to draw me a handrail detail, you know, like I need something that really goes deep. I need software that goes deep. But I think we're in a really great era or really great time for that. You know, a couple years ago, you know, the old school geometer and sort of computational, you know, the sort of like the nerd in me was like, AI is sort of a fad, you know, like you can't take like an LLM that, you know, is trained on Shakespeare and get it to understand Maxwell, you know, and understand geometry. But it turns out, you know, maybe you can actually. And so maybe AI will fill in some of the creative gaps that we needed to fill in order to service our customers in a way that actually meets them where they're at and not sort of proposes generic and overly horizontal solutions to really deep problems.
Mm-hmm. I see. You know, one thing which is quite inspiring is like all the founders have architecture background, and like we see very less like in AEC tech, mostly we see a lot of like engineering construction tech focused companies, but like this kind of like a design tech company like built by like developer designers building tech companies is very less to see. So like, how does a day in your life look like? And how do you guys manage responsibilities?
Yeah, you're asking the good questions. I would say, you know, that an ideal day is, you know, a day spent talking to customers, right? Talking to people who, you know, have ideas on how to make the product, you know, just a little bit better, and are happy to be using it. I would say, in our customer interactions, which is, you know, by far the majority of my day, it's, you know, maybe 75% trying to convince customers that, you know, we're going to get there, and 25%, you know, servicing existing customers and moving them along, right? It's a lot of convincing on a daily basis. You're kind of constantly selling as a founder. So there's that. I spend a lot of time working with our team, you know, moving from kind of project design to product design is a very different process, and the engineers on our team really need to lead. And so spend a lot of time trying to understand how to filter customer feedback into like a clear roadmap that, you know, has sort of now, tomorrow, and 5 years from now, what we're going to build. And, you know, Nate and Raul are really great with this, much better than I am. So thankfully, you know, thankfully we have a really balanced team. You know, Raul is just a brilliant design mind and knows how to like a brilliant designer, but also just a great product designer, brilliant architectural designer. And that has translated into great product design. And then Nate, you know, has just built an incredible product fast, really, really fast. And so luckily we have, a really balanced team that, you know, I think a lot of startups have this issue, right, with understanding how to build product. Like, I think that is a really difficult motion to get into if you've never done it before, coming from architecture. So, but I think we have it covered pretty well.
It's totally different building a Grasshopper script as a web app or a plugin versus like building a scalable product.
Yeah. Well, it's not even just a Grasshopper script. It's like that is like the problem we wanted to solve in all frankness, was like, how do you make sort of Grasshopper and sort of scripts in general, like how do you make that scalable technology? How do you make that scalable software? Mm-hmm. But it's also just, you know, going from designing buildings to designing wireframes and UI UX and all of that. But yeah, thankfully Raul just has a brilliant mind for that. I don't know. I don't know. I like, no day ever looks the same. Yeah. You know, every day is a mess kind of, you know. I try and be structured and schedule my days, but you know, ultimately there's a little bit of, you know, going with the wind, right?
Yeah, and you have to take different roles as a founder depending on the needs of the startup. So it's very, I watched your podcast on the Antler, where, and they mentioned you guys were one of the hardest working team in the incubation they found, and it immediately got me, like, in like as architects or in AEC tech in general, like we have that culture of like giving all in our projects, and I like, no wonder like this guy is a super hard working. Yeah. So tell us like your Antler journey experience, like how was Cedar at the start and what was Cedar at the end of the incubation?
I think Antler was great. I mean, they were our first investors, and I think they really helped us get our minds straight around, you know, what the industry we were building for really looked like. Again, we came in with, you know, hyper design minds and, you know, design on one end and then generative design as a technology on the other. And it's too much innovation at once, right? So they really helped us figure out like how much innovation is necessary and, you know, to spend time talking to customers all day, every day. And so, yeah, I think they really got us straightened out and, yeah, I mean, it was great. And, that was like over a year ago now, I think maybe. Yeah. And since, you know, I've brought on a number of other really great investors and, yeah, I can't say enough good things about, you know, everyone that we've worked with on the investing side. It's really made it possible to build this company in ways that would not have been, you know, had they not.
Got it. And what's your vision of Cedar 1 year from now and 5 years from now?
Yeah. I mean, that's always changing. I mean, you know, really believe in this idea, and I think this is something we'll achieve over the next year or so in AI-driven site planning. And you know, there are some tools on the market now that, you know, take a parametric approach or a somewhat AI-driven approach to, you know, massing and feasibility studies. But you know, we really believe in the power of site planning as a way to help our developer customers better underwrite projects, but also just to bake in really high quality projects in, you know, in urban centers, you know, in urban infill contexts, you know, in a really great way, in a way that hasn't been done. If you think about Texas, right, most of Texas is being designed by civil engineers. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, civil engineers are the ones who are carrying the responsibility for drainage and grading and layout and code compliance and all of these things. But it's not always aligned with, you know, great design, right? Design that, you know, creates walkable, affordable, human, livable, you know, all the great things about the neighborhoods that we love the most, right? And so bringing a level of sophistication through AI that allows you to encode really great design principles, really efficient design principles for urban planning at the site-based level is something that we're really focused on. And we'll be releasing some tools over the next few months that allow, kind of give a first look at what a fully AI-driven site planning process for urban infill residential looks like. And that's kind of the beginning, right? And from there, it's kind of off to the races. But yeah, it's something we're really excited about, the ability to kind of encode design knowledge into early design concepts that drive good planning principles at an urban scale, but on a city, you know, on a parcel-based scale, but in a citywide context. We're really focused on how do we design and build better neighborhoods? And so much of that is just getting the design and the early stage feasibility baked into the underwriting when you acquire the property as a developer. So that's a really long answer. It's not a clear 1-5 year plan, but I think, you know, in a few years, you should be able to come to the Cedar and click on any parcel in the United States. And if it's an urban infill lot, right, of, I don't know, between a few thousand square feet and a few acres, receive a number of really great design and development scenarios that are code compliant, that align with where the market's at, and bake in really high quality urban design, you know, as kind of basis.
Got it. And what are like a piece of advice for a computational designer or an architect listening to this who wants to start their own company?
Oh man. So, you know, one thing, and maybe we can promise each other on this podcast right now or whatever we're calling this, when we're successful in a few years and we've built truly scalable companies in this space, we'll start an incubator or an accelerator for architects. You want to do it? All right, let's do it.
I'm gonna dude, I was thinking about like there's no design tech specific incubator or even funds.
No, there's not. I mean, I think you know, fundamental. I know you've, I think you have Patrick on the podcast. Yeah. I really love those guys. And they seem to be, you know, one of the more design forward investors. I would also say Tishman Speyer, who's an investor of ours, is an incredible design-minded developer, but also investor, you know, venture investor. But there's a few folks out there that are investing in it. But yeah, by no means are we putting enough capital as an industry to work on this problem. But I think part of it is just like the industry doesn't know how to value design as it should. And this has been a problem for a long time within architecture. Hopefully AI can help change that. But yeah, let's start up an accelerator in a few years and really focus on helping architects transition into building scalable technology. Advice wise, man, I think you know, the discussion around the tension between servicing customers and building scalable technology, I don't have an answer for, but I think that there's a great answer there, right? I think there's I think a lot of companies can be built around solving that problem. I don't know exactly what they look like and exactly what sort of niches they're getting started in within the construction and, you know, the AEC industry, but solving that tension, I think, is really important and really valuable. I mean, I would say like, you know, take a class in business and really learn how to value your work, right? Really learn how to ask other people how they value your work and find ways to understand how what you do actually impacts the market and in specific ways. I think I was very naive to this when I made the jump into the startup world, and I'm still having to learn that. Maybe it's obvious for most people, but for me, it wasn't. Then I would also just say, yeah, like totally believe in your skills, right? Like, I think architects are incredible. Architects and engineers are incredible because we think about things geometrically, three-dimensionally, and that allows us to be builders in ways that I think people don't really understand the potential of. Like, I think we're still amazed that, you know, we have customers that will show a fully three-dimensional platform to, and they're like, wow, I've never seen anything like this before. And the power of that is really, it's there. It's true. So I think like, don't undervalue yourself. Learn your value, but don't undervalue yourself and your skills, because they are unique.
That's interesting. What is one thing most people don't know about you and would be surprised to know about you?
Oh, man. Let me think about this. I should have thought of this beforehand. I think one of them is I do like to have fun. I think a lot of my friends and colleagues are like, I was just always working and so intense. But I do like to have fun. I don't know. My dream is probably to build, you know, Cedar into the incredible company that we know it can be, and then, you know, spend at least half my year in Mexico. So I don't know. Love Mexico. Maybe that's something people don't know about me. I don't know.
Yeah, Mexico is fun.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, you definitely gave me like work hard, party hard kind of vibes. Like when I saw some story of yours on Instagram. Actually, we met in Chicago in one of the, I don't know, crypto parties.
Future Gallery is a friend of mine.
That was fun.
Okay, well, maybe it's not so unknown that I do have fun, but yeah.
But like people who met you in person can would not enjoy. Fun fact about your co-founders.
Fun fact about my co-founders. Well, Nate has a dog named Otis, and this guy's a total goober, super cool. I actually haven't met Otis yet, but he joins our phone calls every once in a while, which is pretty funny. And then Raul has a really cute dog named Oliver. And so I'm the only co-founder without a great dog, and that's going to change here soon. But yeah, co-founders need dogs, I think.
Okay. All right. So I have a rapid fire round at the end, but like before that, is there anything which we didn't cover in this interview about your journey, about Siddhar, which you wanted to share?
No, I would say I've had a lot of really amazing mentors along the way, and you know, can't thank them enough, and can't stress enough to the audience how important mentors are in this industry, every industry, but especially this one.
Yeah, like, and especially like, it's, I wanted to share, like, as you're growing your company, like 0 to 1, 1 to 10, it's important to have like a startup mastermind group or something where a group of founders, a group who are equally at your stage, and also a group of people you can reach out who are one stage ahead of you, because then you can share, because they went through the same pain points. So have like 3 to 4 people at least in your network which you can message anytime related to your startup issues and get some good mentorship.
Could not agree more. Yeah.
Yeah. So, all right. So let's jump in. You have 10 to 15 seconds to answer the question, and you got to keep it very brief. Okay. So, all right. Any book or video which made a big impact in your life?
Book that made the biggest impact.
All right.
Vicky Cristina Barcelona.
Let's see. 3 cities which are in your travel bucket list.
Number 2 and probably Melbourne. Sculpt. And going paddling on the river with my co-founders.
I see. Well, a day in your life when you're 50.
50 or 50? 50, yeah. Probably working my ass off. But yeah, working my ass off, building, not only building software, but building buildings again. I want to get back to that. Probably freedom of movement.
I see. Any thing you learned the hard way in your life, like, or the most difficult way?
Every good lesson was learned the hard way. Unfortunately, I don't know if I'm just like a hard-headed person or not, but I would say the thing that is continuously the hardest thing to learn is just meeting people, meeting the market, meeting customers, and meeting people where they're at, you know, not trying to project out what I think things should be or the world as I think it should be, but trying to meet the thing, you know, meet the people that I'm interacting with where they're at, understanding where they're at, empathizing, and sort of finding common ground where they exist. It's, every day I find myself messing this up.
Let's see. The last one is, what would one thing you would suggest young Kyle, young 15-year-old or 18-year-old Kyle?
You think you're disciplined, be more disciplined. Be more, be more disciplined, be more, schedule your days better, understand the value of compounding, you know, everything compounds.
That's a great one. All right. Thanks a lot, Kyle. It was awesome hosting you. I really, really look forward to what you guys build. It's an exciting journey. You guys are building amazing products. So
thanks, man. I really appreciate being here. It's an honor. And I've been following you as well. And let's grab a drink here soon.